You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Yeah, would you like to go first, Guy?
Thank you. Tēnā koe, Amy. Thank you for inviting me on. Ko Guy Toku Ingoa. My name is Guy. I am from Aotearoa, New Zealand. I come from Ngāti Kahinuni Ki Wairarapa, Ngāti Toa Rangatira, and Ngāti Kuata, which are three tribes from the bottom tip of the North Island of Aotearoa and the top tip of the South Island. I am a compulsive creator is what I will say, with my fingers dancing in a lot of different ecosystems at the moment. I'm one part of the network of Permaqueer. I work across climate justice and artivism across the Pacific, Aotearoa, and a range of different other food networks, with a major focus on community organizing and food justice and sovereignty.
Yeah.
And I'll leave that there. I'll pass you, Toad.
Thank you, Guy. Yeah, my name is Toad. I'm one of the other people who work in Permaqueer and one of the co-founders alongside of Guy. Yeah, I'm a permaculture teacher, permaculture community organizer, and also youth ambassador for Permaculture Australia, kind of existing in the ways of like just wanting to have those kind of conversations about like what does permaculture look like outside of white middle class backyards. That's kind of been a lot of my work within Permaqueer and in the permaculture movement and also in other spaces as well. It's, Guy's an incredible artist. I'm an incredible little nerd when it comes to other things in the ecology of the work that we do.
Yeah. Amazing. And why create Permaqueer?
Oh, that's a great question. Initially, where Permaqueer came from is it was during the 2019-2020 NAM lockdowns. We were living in a little permaculture share house, and we both, Guy and I both, managed to learn permaculture from our landlady, who kind of had these really equitable models for like learning permaculture and community living and things like that. And we both kind of thought it was just like some hippy-dippy gardening. But yeah, we didn't really think too much of it. But then when the lockdowns hit, we'd built kind of a community economy around us. We'd actually really focused on food security, community care. We'd had like a dumpster diving redistribution network as one of the permaculture designs. And despite being really low income, we had housing security, food security, and a lot of community well-being. So we kind of initially started permaculture to kind of teach what we had learned to our queer and other communities as well, just to kind of empower them with that. And that was just the initial little step in that direction, but it kind of took some interesting twists and turns, which I might pass to you, Guy, to share a bit more about.
Yeah. I think, you know, there was a real challenge for us in the permaculture space, just because of the sort of cultural dominance of sort of white Western Australian values and how that integrated into our queer communities, our Indigenous communities, POC communities and urban areas. It just didn't work. And so it was sort of out of necessity that we started realizing all these food systems, these housing systems, these like community systems, they work and our communities need them. And so contextualizing them into ways that our communities could understand and interact with in a way that wasn't harmful then just resulted in it blowing up in our faces in the most beautiful ways. And so we ended up doing these web series all across the world, teaching on every continent except Antarctica. It was actually really overwhelming and we were not ready for it, and we learned a lot along the way. And so ever since that, it's this sort of ecological design, food systems, sort of design-based sovereignty has splintered in many, many directions because of the need. You know, everyone lives in the world that we live in right now. And so what Permaqueer is now is truly just responding regeneratively to what we need at the moment, which is so hella vague, but it's underpinned by a lot of community consultation and interaction, and what we've come to land as regenerative design. So yeah.
And so there's a couple themes in there that I want to talk about. But I suppose that one of the things permaqueer brings to all those different communities is a set of values. So while it may be hella vague, you also have a set of values and approaches that you're bringing to those situations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you want to talk a little bit about some of those values? I know relationship was a really big theme of last year's Permaculture is Political.
Yeah, thank you. I think that, being able to like kind of succinctly talk down to this is really kind of a really fun challenge, actually. One of the really important things that drives permaqueer is that things be First Nations led, as well as focusing on self-determination. So like supporting people to lead as opposed to creating things for people. Another really big value of ours is queering, which we have a really beautiful, succinct definition of that by Hannah Breckbill, which is the interrogation of social norms and the building of new relationships and systems to meet the needs of all.
Hmm.
I'll handball it over to you, Guy, to speak to our values.
Yeah. And I also want to pay homage to, you know, the design methodology of permaculture and what that has informed, the three ethics that underpin that, earth care, people care, and fair share or future care, which I think underneath all of the design work that we do and, regenerative community mutual aid, all of these things, if they don't have those a core practice of those ethics underneath them, they actually just mimic the systems that we're in. And that's why these ethics are so important. And you know, I do believe that the values and ethics that we as permaqueer have integrated, you know, with these other values allow a more nuanced and context-based response that's fit for our communities. And so, I think in a lot of our work, we really want to talk about these really critical queering and other values that we have, but they have to work in concert with these other values and design approaches. And so, in a lot of ways, we see those as just the basics of ecological design and how we can be in harmony with our environment, which in the sort of permaculture world takes a very separate sort of view of who we are as a human culture, which is why that First Nations First and Indigenous sovereignty is so important, because that decolonizes the separation between us as human beings and as cultures, living, breathing part of country around us. And so, I'll park that there.
So in many ways, it's also a decolonial project, because there are so many so many words from the Western world or concepts from the Western world that particularly like our broadcasters here at 3CR will often criticize. They'll say something along the lines of, say there's a socialism sort of thing happening. So socialism, yay, certain aspects of socialism. However, sometimes for First Nations people, it can feel like another Western colonial construct if it's not done with, you know, if it's not got a decolonial part to it, for example.
And I think, you know, part of that decolonizing this space is understanding what the responsibility for treaty making is, and treaty is an agreement between two parties and two peoples. And I think, you know, there's a lot of critique from all Western movements of liberation, because it's just trying to get closer to what that place-based, context-based, culture-based approach is. And also, we do need these movements so that Western colonial societies can find those stepping stones to be integrating. And that work shouldn't be done solely by mob. It shouldn't be done by First Nations communities. And so I guess in a lot of ways, this is an experimentation, as all decolonialism is. And here we are.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I wanted to pick up from that was, and this probably gets into permaculture is political and queering permaculture, but one of the things I've talked about on the show with other queer activists is it's a very old discourse in queer politics, and it is actually that word queer, because the broader society. So a lot talk a lot about the cities and suburbs, and they cater towards a nuclear family. They cater towards heteronormative lifestyles and ways of living and ways of thinking, and colonial ways of thinking and ways of doing, capitalist ways of thinking, ways of doing. And there is a pool for LGBT plus people to assimilate and become homonormative. And it's a very long conversation, but one of the things I kind of want to resist in my approach, which is an ongoing practice and it's a constant self-reflection, is kind of resisting the gentrification of queerness.
Yeah, I think that's... Yeah, apologies for interrupting. I just got very excited.
That's it. I'll park it there.
Thank you. That's a really, really big piece for us, is how to... I think there's an element of queering, or like queerness, which is like, you know, it's... it can be antagonistic. It's clowning. It's creating new ways of culture, community, living, loving, thriving amongst a society that's trying to erase you or invisible you or assimilate you. I don't think that assimilation is the pathway towards liberation. And I have a really strong value in that. Yeah. I'll let you speak for a bit, Guy, because there's something I'm forming in the back of my brain in response to this.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, that whole what is development, what is growth, what is gentrification, what and I think within, you know, the confines of urban Western visibility, it's really hard to know what growth is outside of this, you know, gentrified sort of capitalist extraction model. And I think that's why coming back to those ethics and principles of how our environment works around us, and understanding what pattern knowledge is, understanding what seasonal knowledge is, understanding how water operates, once we build these literacies of recognizing our environment around us, we can recognize what is best for the living ecology. And that's reflected in how our cultures behave. That's reflected in how First Nations cultures behave. And so that's why I think a design methodology, and I really like, you know, the core of this co-papa, of this project, is about agency. How do we have agency to come up with different ways of being and different ways of doing? And within that, queerness is so important, because we know what we have isn't working. We know what we're doing is slowly, not even slowly, really quickly killing us from the inside as cultural environmental creatures. And so we have to have other ways of thinking. We have to have principled queer approaches that are just like, hey, that's really fucking weird. That's just totally bonkers. And that doesn't look like anything. And that reintroduces that diversity, And once that's paired with how our ecosystems grow, and how in nature, how water, how soil, how all of these bedrocks of existence, once those find alignment, that's when we start to create these really generative cultures and these ways of being and these approaches. And when I think about treaty building and treaty making, that's the attitude, that's the capacity, that's the practice that we all need to have. I'll pass back to you, Toad, if that's clicked a bit more in your head.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for speaking so eloquently about that. And if I zoom in on one thing that you said, particular, Amy, about the gentrification of queerness, I see this in a lot of movements of liberation. Like, I'm a big freak for systems thinking. So for me, I'm like, beyond just the languaging or the frameworks, like, how do complex systems organize apart from just the values of things like, patriarchy or white supremacy, beyond just that initial value? Like, how do they... even when you take out those particular kinds of, oh, this person is better than that person, what are the kind of patterns of those systems and how do they operate? Because we can't use those patterns to dismantle those systems. For example, I can use the language of feminism to be a misogynist. Yes. I can use the language of anti-racism to enact my very whiteness into the space. So for us, it's like, and this idea of queering being gentrified, I think that like, queerness or like true queering breaks homogenization. It introduces complexity. It focuses on interrelationship. And I think that the gentrification of queering is the homogenizing of all experiences. This, if I get a little bit nerdy, a very like kind of neoliberal identitarianism, this flattening of complexity and flattening of relationship and context.
Yeah.
And for me, like what we do at Permaqueer is we teach systems thinking in a really non-threatening way through ecology. And that's the way in which we can, for example, like we can talk about the function of a monoculture. Collapses complexity down to simplicity. It's really good at mass extraction. And, you know, there's many times less nutrients in a crop of tomatoes than there is a food forest. But, you know, we'd have that homogenization for that mass extraction. They're prone to pest, disease, and collapse. Suddenly, because everything's are no longer collaborating or cooperating, they're competing. So you see this purity politic emerge. Anything that blows in is seen as a threat to the purity of the crop. So I kind of teach about that from an ecological perspective. So then I don't have to do a huge amount of work when I say, well, what is the function of a social monoculture? And just like we have, like in an ecosystem, you can't monoculture your way out of a monoculture. Homogenization, purity politics, mass extraction isn't going to undo a monoculture, and it's not going to undo a social monoculture.
It's the ironic thing, just on purity politics with it, when the your politics, even if it has like a left-wing origin, could become carceral logic. It could actually become policing of how to be. For example, I could say, I could be so against the assimilation of queers that I start policing what a queer should be. And it's very tempting to do that, actually. It's actually something we have to be mindful of as we go forward in the world.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you've grown up in a colonial Western context, generally you're given a very select set of tools. And, you know, like that thing, if you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And really what we're trying to focus on with Permaqueer and the whole queering ideology and the kind of ecological design is, what are the other tools that are available to us? Understanding through complexity, through ecosystems, through interrelationship, how do we diversify our toolbox and become a bit more discerning about which tool do we use where, and that these tools are not always scalable. These tools are not always transferable.
And I think as well, in you know, in terms of agency in this sort of queer regenerative design approach, our focus, you know, is acknowledging that each ecosystem will self-organize to its, you know, its community's needs, and how do we create environments that are conducive to doing that, and that within the confines of Western, all the Western structures that we have here in so-called Australia, they sort of really pressure a small window of decisions that it wants you to make. And so a lot of this work has been exploring what self-determination is, what agency is, what are the conditions for sovereignty to emerge, and also what is this concept of pseudo-sovereignty that we're offered by these systems around us that mean the decisions we make about housing, the decisions we make about food, the decisions we make about care and relationship, we make this the same set of decisions to continue down that pathway of supporting these systems. And so it's been a big exploration about how do we create conditions for sovereignty? What are the mechanisms? What are the design relationships that we can build to ease that pressure so that it's not pseudo-sovereignty that we're making decisions from? Because we will always do that as human beings on this earth, as a socialized species. And how do we create some more freedom in that? And I don't think we necessarily have the like answers for that, but we've definitely been playing around with that for a little while.
Yeah, and I think that is part of, because you did the talk Queering Permaculture at last year's Permaculture is Political. I think that is part of what being queer is. It is playing around. It's not really defined, and it shouldn't be. It's always evolving. I guess the most prominent speaker right now on gender who people are familiar with is Judith Butler, and they refuse to give a definition of gender, for example, because that is probably impossible, but also restrictive and imposes things onto it that could be oppressive or restrained.
To counter Judith, I do have my definition of queerness. So my definition is you know how like you've got that little like filament in your eye and you try to look at it and it keeps moving away? That's queerness.
Nice.
Yeah.
So speaking of permaculture as political, I'd like to congratulate you on a great event. It was an incredible event. And I thought we could talk about it to give the audience an idea of the kind of events you organize and why they should head to these sorts of things. And we'll also talk about your upcoming one as well.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's really hard to pick. I've got my list here of all the speakers. I attended one of the days in person and the rest I've caught up on. I think because we were talking a lot of decolonialism, there was a big theme of decolonialism in a lot of the speakers. You had a lot of Indigenous speakers. You had probably very well known to the audience is Tyson Yunker Porter was there. He talked about the ferals, which I guess was New Age style appropriation of Indigenous cultures, to sort of maybe not do full justice because it was a lengthy conversation, but what are some of it was definitely a highlight having Tyson and his style of yarning and humor. I also really loved I've heard of her before, but Starhawk, or I'd heard of them before Starhawk. That was quite inspiring, Starhawk's work and life. And also locally, Tammy Jonas and how they approach agroecology, and also in particular how their experience in India and the different relationships people and Indian farmers and women had with food growing. There was just a huge, beautiful diversity. What were some of the favorite, it's probably hard to pick for you because you probably love them all, but what are some great talks that you might think listeners might like to go find on YouTube? These are all available on YouTube, by the way, at Permaqueers. It's all one word, Permaqueer on YouTube.
Thank you. Thank you. We had such a great time putting that on that event. It's kind of, you know, our dream job is we get to talk to a bunch of baddies about the incredible work they do in the world. It's a pleasure. And, you know, it was a big fundraiser for a couple of Palestinian organizations as well as some local First Nations orgs. I think one of my favorite, like, something that really made me reflect on, like, the, you know, the bush foods industrial complex that we have here in so-called Australia, Zena Cumston really spoke in depth about that. I think it's now less than 1% of income from the bush foods industry actually goes towards First Nations people, and what does it actually mean, particularly like when we're experiencing things like, you know, oncoming climate catastrophe. Our food systems, we really should be pivoting more towards traditional, like Indigenous foods here, and how does that happen without then just engaging in a further neo-colonialism? That was a really big ooh moment. Like, how do you bring in Indigenous foods in a way that doesn't further colonize all the work that you're trying to do? That was a really fantastic one. Everyone kind of brought something really, I mean, it's cheesy to say, but everyone brought in something really unique. And I think that's what we really tried to focus on in the back end things of this whole queering is how do we build this narrative of social change from all these different voices. Did you want to throw something into the
I also just wanted to add, for our 3CR listeners, there was a fantastic talk by Farid, I hope I've got the name right, Tamala, because we've been the only media voice for Palestine since the 70s, and we've been targeted a lot by different entities for voicing Palestinians. So that was another brilliant one, and that was about Bar Ali farming. Traditionally.
Yeah, Fareed's was absolutely fantastic, and it was a real joy, you know. And I also want to put a deep love to our regenerative community and network that, like, you know, how these speakers, these topics came out was through the whole network of relationship, of trust, of understanding. And that's not to say that we, you know, there was a lot of people that we didn't know personally in that, but, you know, regenerative ways of being are based off of stable relationships. They're based off of a continued ethic and value that was consistent across all of these speakers, which was really beautiful. And I think if I was, it's impossible to say which were my favorites, but I would highly recommend people listening to any of the First Nation, all of them generally, but also the First Nations presentations. I think, you know, colonialism is always a trend between everything that we talk about, but if I'm completely honest, we all know that the solution is beyond colonialism. Mm. And so listening to these voices that have contextualized their solutions within this current moment, that is our best pathway to liberation. And, you know, permaculture is in and of itself a way that we can establish and remember and build that practice of relationship with place. But there are many cultures and communities across the world that never lost that. Mm. And it's up to our brokering of relationships with them and understanding and learning from them that we'll be able to step into these more equitable regenerative food systems. And so I'd highly recommend listening to all of the First Nations speakers. It's just absolutely beautiful historical storytellings of the gods of Palestine, of all these different beautiful, you know, Tyson's one about all the signals and
yeah, that the snakes,
the echidna sex walk sort of thing. He's so hilarious. He's so brilliant and he's so profound in how he shares. And that was consistent across a lot of them. And then also, you know, for people who feel like maybe they need more of a, I don't know, a Western justified perspective, there's also some really amazing speakers from governmental roles, such as Deepa, who takes a sort of more internal, you know, because community approaches are also fraught. We all know that and we love it. And to be part of community is to be inconvenienced. Mm. And so I think this series approaches this, you know, community food systems from many different angles so that we can sort of understand the challenges, the limitations, and the dreams and the desires of how we can move forward together. So yeah, a few of those in there that I'd definitely recommend.
Yeah, and we've kind of spoken a little bit about what the talks we've had, but I guess in a very queer way, coming at it from the back end to the front.
Yeah.
yeah, the reason we actually put this on was because we kept, like, we were just these kind of, you know, hornet kicking queers in permaculture who were like talking about decolonizing and things. And, you know, we, you know, on the weekly, we get odd emails with Bible verses or, you know, all the things. But one of the consistent things that we kept getting was permaculture isn't political. Mm. And even Bill Mollison was famous for saying that, even though, you know, he was out in the streets protesting for Indigenous rights back in the day. He's a complex man. And I think that we all need to just, like, for better and for worse, when we, you know, make heroes out of individuals, we collapse their complexity of full humans. I've definitely seen that happen with Bill for the good that he's done and also the not great things. Mm. But yeah, so we kept hearing permaculture isn't political. But of course, any kind of land management practice that comes from systems thinking, observations of First Nations people, different kind of schools of sciences that practices land management on stolen country, who gets access to food, who gets access to land, all of these things are deeply political. And so, like, part of our marketing was that we had permaculture isn't political with the NT crossed out, because we were just so tired of hearing, oh, permaculture isn't political. Why are you trying to make it political? Whereas, and we wanted to showcase, like, what does permaculture, what are the critiques that people have for permaculture from different marginalized perspectives, but also the ways in which different communities who are on the fringes have taken regen ag, permaculture, agroecology, these other practices, and what they've managed to do and innovate and push forward outside of just white middle-class backyards. Hmm. And turns out these practices can be really political, really radical, really community-centered around, like, food justice and climate justice and First Nations justice. It's just they don't get the screen time or the, you know, the show time that teaching people how to grow carrots next to tomatoes in your little private backyard gets. That's great. I love that. But, you know, if we have these ethics around earth care, people care, and fair share, those become deeply political things. And it's just the, you know, the tension sometimes between the design philosophy and practice and those ethics and the movement, which is made up of people and all of that complexity there.
There's kind of a lot of things that are coming up to the fore at the moment as well, particularly in terms of the way that we imagine, for example, essential work and also sort of essential community life or essential caregiving. And how those function. If we think about sort of the way that queer family often takes very, very sort of different forms and very, you know, important and meaningful forms that often don't match the picture of normative, heteronormative family life. But how so many of the affordances or the restrictions or the kind of the governmental sort of imagining of the way that we should live and what we need to live and what we need to survive really is shaped around heteronormativity. You know, it's around the family life in the suburb, as opposed to many, you know, single individuals who have shared queer family, both sexual and community connections that sustain them and that kind of give them life and give them sort of energy and comfort and safety and security and support.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
I might have a little slide in between the permaculture's political and the new event.
Yeah.
And that's talking about like the dreamings of what permaculture can look like outside of these spaces.
Yeah.
I was really lucky to be one of the youth ambassadors for Permaculture Australia to the International Perma Youth Convergence in Timor-Leste. To like kind of learn about what youth-led permaculture is happening over there. And I just want to like, outside of, you know, the very kind of global north bubble or global minority bubble, what permaculture can look like can be radical. Like I was seeing people who were using, you know, post-violent occupation, were using permaculture just as a framework just to kind of support their own indigenous practices. Engage in recharging the water table to bring back like 700 springs, which was preventing a lot of conflict, like, and wild event, amazing, complex, you know, full spectrum, and I can't get into it this moment. But one of the things that was really, really big to hear, it was a talk by the president of Timor-Leste who came to the event, and he was talking about how with the oncoming climate catastrophes, the global north isn't coming to save us. So how do we actually use all these different practices, permaculture, agroecology, our traditional indigenous practices, to kind of build ourselves in a way that makes us resilient for the future? And I think that there's that element as well, like the kind of, it's not disaster, well, it's kind of disaster preparedness permaculture, and that like community organizing is disaster preparedness. Permaculture can be disaster preparedness. And these kinds of, like when we saw, like when the COVID lockdowns happened, what we thought was really kind of just sweet and friendly and like lovely actually meant that we built meaningful relationships with our neighbors and around food sovereignty and community organizing and these dumpster diving redistribution networks that was led by a woman that we lived with. And so these practices that seem really sweet, it's like, how do we actually understand them to be something that can protect us into the future? And that, you know, it's better to prepare for something rather than in the collapse and in the ruins, try to pull ourselves together. That was a very long-winded way of saying in which what they're doing in Timor-Leste, that's youth-led, is far more radical than what I'm seeing a lot of the times here.
Yeah.
In that people who, out of necessity, are leading the way. Innovation is, you know, is on the edge. And that's one of those queer principles as well of like, you know, in permaculture, we have that principle of use the edge and value the marginal. I don't love that language of use the edge, but by being in relationship with our edge, innovation always happens at the edge. And how do we design our systems to be in mutual, like reciprocity with those on the edge.
Hmm. I have a segment called Urban Wasteland Survival Guide, where every week I will have like a zine or some you know, just some tips on foraging or something like that. And a lot of inspiration comes from the Global South because, yeah, as you said, out of necessity, people in the Global South have to develop ways to survive. And there are technologies, low-tech technologies in particular, that are coming out that are being used extensively in Global South. And the reasons are not great why it's happening, but they're also quite amazing technologies like solar cookers or biofilters for filtering water. It's like there is a resilience being built out of in the Global South because they are actually in the front lines of this.
Yeah, and I see permaculture where it's being led by people in the global majority of Global South, but I have to speak that devil into the room as well.
Yeah.
I also see permacolonialism, which is where, you know, generally white affluent people go and do a lot of white saviorism. It's not about building relationships or reciprocity. It's about going in and teaching them how to do something, whereas permaculture can be shared in ways that uplifts local leaders to kind of support their own traditional ways of being. It can be really great or really terrible.
I just want to add one thing in the end of that permaculture is political, and that's also about sort of one of the many intentions that we had for that. You know, a large driving force of this permaqueer project is to, as we keep coming back to, is creating agency or having more agency. And we thought a lot about, yeah, we want to present these ideas, but really what we want is engagement. What we want is organizing. What we want is for these amazing, you know, case studies or ideas or different food solutions to naturalize into all of the viewers' communities and what that looks like. And we know change is slow and progressive and unfolds in a lot of ways, but in the same regenerative ethic, every time we do an event like that, we constantly reflect on it, you know, what actual impact, what relationship, what resource, what how is this actually showing up in our communities. And I think, you know, as beautiful and as wonderful as all the speakers are and everything, there's a just tragic reality of the state of our climate, of the state of our food system, of the state of our water. You know, the announcements about the global water shortage that we now have, that we know we have, what we are stepping into, we have never seen before. And I think, you know, it's really beautiful to hear the urban wasteland and disaster preparedness. And also we urge all listeners to really inform yourself about what urban risks are, what resilience looks like, because, you know, we're in a truly are in a concrete wasteland that is all of the food, the resources that come in and out are deeply monitored through this mechanism of capitalism, and that needs to change, and you are at direct risk as we move forward. And, you know, acknowledging that it is the global minority, the global north, you know, definitely not in the same kinds of risks as we do have in the global south, but this is all connected, and we need this action to be mobilized in our communities. And so I also feel compelled to acknowledge, like, the funds and resources. We talk about, you know, how do we do these things and how does this operate. We had the privilege of applying for a charity pot fund for Lush, the cosmetics company that supports a lot of regenerative initiatives, that funded us to be able to produce this for the fundraiser, for everything that came along. And that is something that we're committed to paying forward as well. And so in the same vein of what does this look like in your community, it's an open invitation. If some of these ideas, they spark interest in you, or you want to do something about it, please reach out to us. Please have a chat. You know, this is so important, and we love exploring what this expression looks like in many different contexts, and genuinely want to support people doing that. And that's how we've tried to position ourselves to be capable of helping and supporting and creating resources around that. So the permaculture is political, never ends, and we roll on. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you. You both have such beautiful way of expressing things, and I really love it. Let's maybe move on to this. I hear there's something coming up. There's a special something.
Yeah. So we, after kind of years of doing this work, and just kind of having that back end thought of like, how do we, like, basically the model in which we do a lot of our community organizing that we spoke a bit about briefly, me and rather systems thinking, Guy, particularly focus on self-determination, and just have kind of put together this lovely little short course called Queer Regenerative Design, in which kind of puts together a lot of our queer theory, trauma-informed design, permaculture. There's a lot of lovely little things in there. I'm just kind of going off on things, but Guy might be able to speak to it more eloquently than what I'm able to in this moment.
Yeah.
Thanks, David. I mean, this is a weird little beautiful, ugly child of all of our work. You know, we were teaching permaculture design, and then all of these things like kept on coming up that didn't really fit, you know, they didn't really fit in the curriculum, or, you know, that was like, what is that? You know, and people kept on asking, what is that? And so we made a note of it. And after over 5 years of engaging communities all across the world, this is an expression of all of those questions of what is that, and then asking that question to the next community and the next community. And so it's aggregated between the desires of what regeneration looks like in community. And this, it's bizarre. There's, you know, while it's been informed by permaculture, it's entirely developed in its own way. And last year we had this amazing privilege to work alongside Social Enterprise Australia. This queer regenerative design offering has been solely just for individuals and community, but we applied this to social enterprises all across Australia and asked them at that level of systems influence, of community influence, of, you know, resources, of all that, what does it look like for you? And so that's re-informed some of the questions that we're asking moving forward. So this is an 8-week online course. We do have scholarships for it, so, you know, finance is not a barrier. However, if you can afford, we do urge that people do pay along for that. That being said, it's not a barrier. And we meet with a community of like-minded regenerative thinkers, and we just explore all of the questions, all of the frameworks, and we ask, what does it look like in your context? How do you feel about this? What is sticky? What is not sticky? And so what you'll get out of it, I cannot tell you. You're welcome to take a look at our website for what other people have gotten out of it. And yeah, it's probably our favorite program because it's really intimate. It is not, you know, it's not this big show of organizations or whatever. It's community to community and exploring questions that we don't necessarily get to ask a lot. We'll pass back to you, Todd, if there's anything else you want to say.
Thank you. I was just trying to in my brain be like, how would I succinctly describe this? And I guess it would be for anyone who is wanting to engage in some kind of change making, like positive regenerative change making, how do we learn from ecosystems, systems thinking, and other communities to make change without replicating the systems of violence that we're trying to undo? That would be my little tagline.
No notes.
So if people hear about this after the event starts, because it starts next Monday, are they able to jump in as the course progresses through to April?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We've got our online recorded version of it.
Ah, beautiful.
Like an intimate environment.
Yeah.
So we may potentially offer just the online recorded version of it, just because of the sanctity of that group. However, we will, you know, all the people that are coming along, we'll ask them to see how they feel about it.
Yeah.
Might, if we do get a lot of numbers as well, I'll put a little waitlist function on the website. If we get a bunch of people, we'll just run a concordant one. We can definitely do that.
So yeah. It's running Monday 23rd of February to Monday 13th of April.
Yeah.
And each meeting each Monday at 5:30 to 7 p.m. Is that weekly?
Yeah, weekly. Yeah. 2.5 hours online. Mini breaks, though. It's not, you know, we understand.
Absolutely. And geez, I didn't realize it was so soon. I was going to look at it and maybe be able to join. I've just gone on Centrelink, so that's good to hear you've got scholarships.
Absolutely.
But moving back, what is trauma-informed design? I find that very interesting. I'm someone who lives with complex trauma and dissociation, so I just find that personally quite interesting.
No, I can absolutely speak to that. I'm also someone with a diagnosis of complex PTSD. So a lot of it is, like, we use a lot of the window tolerance model.
Okay, yeah.
Which, you know, has strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
But a lot of the idea is, how do we design systems that allow people to come to the edge of the window and to expand the window? Mm. And we understand that when we're within that window of tolerance, it's easier for nervous systems to engage in collaborative, long-term thinking and also question their values.
Mm.
Whereas when we're outside of the window of tolerance, we're inherently geared towards, it's not impossible, but we're more geared towards short-term, competitive, extractive thinking.
Yeah.
And we're more likely to fall on those extractive tools. So what is our challenge as community organizers and designers to help people, like, structurally come within the window and help people stretch that window?
Hmm.
And to add to that as well, you know, I think in systems thinking, when we're trying to design for systemic change or behavioral change, community change, unless we have a trauma lens on it, the binary of how people should behave gets applied to the entire community. And we see that in people reach for punitive carceral responses. People don't understand the plethora of different trauma responses. And it reinforces, unless you have a trauma-informed lens to systems design, it just reinforces the same system, because we're projecting how people should respond. And we see it time and time again, where people don't understand diversity, they don't understand difference. We have racist responses, homophobic responses, ableist responses, left, right, and center, exploding everywhere, because there's not that understanding of how diversity and how different lived experiences and the challenges of these systems of violence, how they play out on communities.
Hmm.
Mm.
And if I speak to that a little bit, that's when you start to see, you know, we've all been in very lovely left organizing spaces, for better and for worse. It's when we don't have those trauma-informed approaches that we start to see the, as Guy said, the racist, homophobic, sexist practices being used by, but also being used with progressive language. We start to see the purity politics, the policing, the this, the that, but using the languages and the frameworks of liberation to enact those same systems of violence upon each other. That idea of shifting a boot from one neck to another is liberation.
Hmm.
Lateral violence is not liberation.
No.
No. No.
I love that. No.
Yeah.
There was one last thing that you said, Guy, if you wanted to, you said there was another topic that you would like to squeeze in, and I'm happy for you to squeeze it in while I've got you here.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, I appreciate it. It was funny, I had to go back over the notes because I was like, what was I talking about? Yeah, and I wanted to talk about mutual aid specifically,
yep.
Ecological mutual aid. And yep. I think, you know, as we continue to see these water systems, climate systems, food systems, political systems, all of these things continue to pressure and break down, and, you know, the ways that these breakdowns express will just be a hardening across everything that, you know, supports us. And I think it's a long way to fall from the global north and in his so-called Australia, where, you know, we're so inflated by the ongoing genocide of this land and the extraction of the minerals and the fossil fuel industry and the gas industry that props up the Australian economy and all of the things and the benefits and the privileges that we get to have here. And there's just a reality that is wrong and unsustainable. And also these systems are fracturing, you know, looking at what happened in the food system all across Australia during COVID was a huge example of how fragile this food system is. And that is without the extreme climate conditions that we're currently having. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about yeah, what explorations of mutual aid look like in our communities. And I put in ecological mutual aid there for a range of reasons, mainly because, you know, we've been talking a lot about where the thought comes from. And I think when people, when we say resources or money or, you know, housing, it's so deeply embedded in the transactional extractive approach of capitalism. That's how we, you know, and when I was talking before about pseudo-sovereignty, we believe we can achieve sovereignty by working and exchanging the tokens that we get for the thing that we need. And thus we've maintained sovereignty in our little what's available to us. And so I've seen a lot of really awesome mutual aid initiatives, and then a lot of ones like actually really limited by the thought that underpins them. And so I think I'm not sure if you want to add anything more here, but this was more about how do we look to the ways that our environment shares resources, the seasons that we belong to, the flows of water, the flows of soil, and how do we build our mutual aid mechanisms around those realities. And I think once it leads from a principle of country, an ecological principle of our landscape, it's harder to get swept up in the challenges that I've seen in other mutual aid mechanisms. But I'm also interested in, you know, from your perspective, Amy, you know, you're sharing a whole lot of awesome stuff in the urban wasteland. I'm interested in what mutual aid has looked like, what you've come across, what you've heard from, and yeah, what that is looking like in urban environments, or hoping to look like, whichever way you want to take that.
I think that people don't realize often the ways in which they already do something akin to mutual aid. And so one of the things is, so there's obviously lefties and stuff in town who'll do things like Food Not Bombs. And I've also interviewed someone from the Really, Really Free Market on this show. And there's been lots of mutual aid fundraisers for Palestine and MOB since the October 7 attacks. Well, the ramping up of genocide, because obviously the genocide in Palestine is going on longer. Something I try to focus on, I've seen like a lot of mutual aid fundraisers that got a lot of activists who are already burnt out and overextended trying to scrape together money. And well, one thing I notice is that it's often the vast majority of donors are other people who don't have a lot of money. I know that it's sort of sometimes the ones who are the most privileged give the list. But also just that I think one of the things I want to encourage, and I try to follow in the footsteps a little bit of Uncle Robbie and some of the other presenters here, of thinking about language in ways in which it makes things more accessible. And it's always an interesting challenge on the radio to say something like capitalism, and sometimes you need it, you just label it capitalism, you know, what we need is capitalism. We need to have more of this type of policy, blah blah blah. But then there's also reaching people who instantly switch off at the mention of a critical word. And so I like to point out to people when they are doing acts of mutual aid, like a lot of people don't realize it, but like bread pantries, the people love them, right? People, particularly in Melbourne, they love doing bread pantries. They love doing like the little book libraries on their little front houses. And while these may not, you know, be a complete mutual aid apparatus, you know, Daddy Kropotkin isn't ticking all the boxes for it. But I like to think about ways to sort of bring that to the community and make them think about ways in which they're already doing it, and then seeing the benefit of learning about more about it and how it works. Yeah, I try to keep it open, basically. Sorry, I was very long-winded. I wasn't expecting that question, but it's a great question, and I'm probably going to think about it more since. It's such a funny one because it's become such a big thing on Instagram. Like, so there's always a mutual aid request out there, and I'm more of an. I have my thoughts, but they're still sort of, I still think about it a lot. I think that my main thing is developing connection and making sure people do connection, kicking down those fences, talking to people in real life, which is why I love the neighborhood houses that I'm supporting on the show at the moment, because they're an opportunity for diverse people from different parts of the community to meet each other. That trans people are human beings. Oh, they're not that bad, you know, that kind of thing. It's a way of bypassing, you know, mainstream media's filtration of news and propaganda as well.
Yeah.
Sorry, that wasn't really an answer. But
No. Thank you.
Yeah.
Something that just popped into my mind while we were talking about mutual aid as well. And just like, you know, the idea that like it's on the fringe or at the edges where like you see the most innovation. I really like, I live on Bundjalung country, but specifically like in Lismore, Widjiwabwaibal country. And I have to give a shout out to the mutual aid that I see happening here in response to the community-led structures that have emerged around mutual aid given post-flood, like, catastrophe. And I don't know how that would fit into your framing, Guy, but that I just also, from that, like, that queering principle of, like, that on the edge, when it has to be community-led and, like, services have often disappeared, I'm always really interested in the structures that emerge organically from community.
Yeah, and I think that sort of often gets the most purist in a way, like not in like a politically purist like we were talking before, but like in the most sort of honest way sometimes when it emerges organically from the community. Not always, but yeah, I always love working with people who, for example, say they're talking about working class issues, but they've never read Marx or anything. So they don't use words like bourgeoisie or proletariat, which is fantastic because it's such a great way to alienate people. But they hit all the marks. Uncle Robbie, you know, he speaks in a way that is just so engaging, but also I've seen so many people when I was involved at Camp Sovereignty walk up there from all walks of life, all kind of backgrounds, and him just walk up and talk to them and suddenly having them doing ceremony and all this stuff, and they just were happening walking by, you know. And I think there's this, I always reflect and think about connection in that way. And I do think organically sometimes out of these communities responding to disaster or an issue in the community, some really great things come about.
You hit something really, really fantastic there about like the idea of the exclusionary nature sometimes of some of our ideology and movements and things. I don't think we necessarily have time to even get into it, but yeah. I just like wanted to flag that yeah, moving away from that that purity ideology around these things is how do we actually have conversations with people from different areas of life. I know that a lot of queer people who come from like regional backgrounds who move to NAM and then like don't understand the very academic language in LGBT or queer spaces and like become excluded. And like, once again, from like a systems thinking perspective, are we using purity politics, homogenization? Are we creating hierarchies of power rather than hierarchies of function and responsibility? Like, yeah. I could nerd out about that for an hour, so I will put a pause on myself because that is something I feel strongly about.
Just to close on that mutual aid thing, I think.
Thank you.
Definitely from me, there's a big interest for our next sort of like web series to be around explorations of what mutual aid looks like. And, you know, to speak to what I said before around, you know, perhaps some failures as we're seeing really like, you know, and this is not to diminish what direct mutual aid is, but it is an individual answer to a systemic problem. And I sort of view it in the same way as I view direct action, and that it's really awesome at doing a really targeted thing in this moment, and it's really useful. And also we need to be thinking about what other structural systems and structures are. And I think as we continue to see climate breakdown and, you know, the economic impacts of what this is, we need to continuously think about how do we replace these systems that we rely upon in a mutual social smaller structure. And I think There are a lot of people who I hear saying that, but they're really not comfortable trading off accountability for, you know, they will say ACAB to the end of the day, but we won't set up accountability protocols so that we can create, you know, accountability in our own communities. And I think, what are those structures that ensure that we have, you know, a smaller version in the global north? We rely on this giant nanny state that we say we hate, but we benefit from so much. And how do we explore and play around with the functions that they serve? Well, what is a community version of that? How do we organize around that? And there are many amazing examples of it. And the more we see those and the more we engage with them, the more stable our communities will be moving forward. And so that will be a big focus for us. And if any of the listeners or yourself, Amy, are interested in what that looks like, we're, you know, please let's continue this discourse and see what emerges. I would love to see a mutual aid sort of web series to build on.
Yeah.
What our collection is.
Absolutely. And I can think of people at 3CR involved in mutual aid, because obviously we're a bit of a network as well. If you ever do that, I can make some recommendations.
Perfect. Wonderful.
Because we have...
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.